listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2014 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. London-born Edward St. Aubyn is well known, I know, to many of you for his semi-autobiographical Patrick Melrose novels, which have been cited as one of the best fictional cycles in contemporary fiction. The five Melrose novels include At Last and Mother's Milk, which was shortlisted for the 2006 Man Booker Prize, and he's the author as well of the novels A Clue to the Exit and On the Edge. St. Aubyn writes sentences which are moments for readers to gasp, really, at an enriched comprehension of human behavior in all its variability, from innocence to sharp cruelty. He's also noted that in the process of writing, he has sometimes found his own emotional resolution. The revelation, he writes, is in the process of writing. His work has been compared to Evelyn Waugh and Oscar Wilde, but he might be, it's been suggested, more like the literary heir of Jane Austen, because no member of the posh classes escapes St. Aubyn's devastatingly accurate social critique and tart, ironic wit. His new book, Lost for Words, which he'll discuss with Michael tonight, is a departure from his earlier novels, but the satiric scenarios and acid humor he applies to the follies of literary self-aggrandizement will be recognizable to all fans of the Melrose novels. Lost for Words skewers Britain's most prestigious Booker Prize, the competing authors, as well as the judges and corporate, political, and media interests that influence such prizes. And it cuts to the quick of some of the deepest questions about the place of art in our celebrity-obsessed culture. And it should be noted, with delicious irony, that the book which satirizes literary prizes was recently awarded the United Kingdom's only literary prize for comic fiction. And tonight, Mr. St. Aubyn will be in conversation with Michael Silverblatt, LA's own reader laureate, and I didn't make that phrase up. Michael, as I'm sure all of you know, is the host of KCRW's half-hour radio show Bookworm, which he created for KCRW-FM, one of our media partners, in 1989. And here at Aloud, we've had the good fortune to witness Michael's deep tenderness for and rare comprehension of literature. In many of his past Aloud interviews, you may remember his conversation with Marilyn Robinson, who he will rejoin this fall, or Richard Powers. And you can find these and many others in our Aloud archive. But Michael also has something in common with one of our very recent Aloud guests, the high wire artist Philippe Petit. And that's because Michael has described doing an interview to walking a tightrope. So with that, please welcome Michael Silverblatt and Edward St. Aubyn.
I'm so nervous about introductions that by the time they're over, you'll wish you were gone. And so I'm going to start directly with a question. This is a much more overtly funny, even hilarious novel than the Patrick Melrose novels. Were you yearning to escape them?
I escaped them naturally by writing the last chapter of At Last, and this is a celebration of the kind of sense of freedom I had from those preoccupations. And I wanted to see if I could write a book that I enjoyed writing and that was enjoyable to read with no harrowing content at all. And I never enjoyed writing a novel. It was a kind of gruesome, life-threatening obligation. And at the same time, it was very oppressive to write under those conditions. And there was a side of me which had been suppressed, really, in favor of of completing the Melrose story, which was playful, mimetic, mischievous. And that's what's come out here.
Now, tell me, I'm very curious about this, but you look so much happier and healthier than you did the last time I saw you. Is it because you are free of that material?
Yes, I didn't know until now that I looked happy and healthy. But I'm a bit vain to take up your remark as if I knew it already. But I certainly, you know, by the end of At Last, I'd achieved the kind of basic freedom of being able to place my attention where I chose to, rather than having it stolen by a set of obsessions and compulsions and preoccupations and memories. And this is what I've done with that freedom, yeah. And it's great, yes, it's great not to be forced to think about things that you don't want to think about.
Because when we spoke together in two different shows about the five Patrick Melrose novels, and we, you know, it's impossible not to wonder at the end, how is this author going to invent kindness, since cruelty, emotional cruelty of many different kinds, are in the braiding of those novels? And much to my surprise, you see, I was expecting when I picked this up that this was going to be a very fierce, even ferocious, satire of all the rest of the writing going on in the Commonwealth, and that there would be no one left standing. Instead, the book is infected with a kind of, I would say, lunacy, a kind of manic quality. There are many literary parodies of bad writing in it. Bad writing of every kind. Historical bad writing, thriller bad writing, wonderful surprises that come up in italics in the book. And each chapter, it has 30 chapters, and you see, it's not a long book, so you read it at a clip, and each chapter is between 6 and 8, 9 pages long. The final chapter, chapter 30, is around 30 pages, 3 times as long as any, and it's at the actual Booker Prize, and it's like a festival. It's like the Shakespearean marriage scene at the end of one of Shakespeare's comedies. It comes, you think it's going to be what they used to call, now please, I don't know what the words I'm about to use mean, okay? I really don't, I honestly don't. But you think it's going to be Menippean satire? Do you know what that means?
No idea. No idea. Thank God there are two experts.
But
on
it
stage.
Seems to involve, you know, fleas and corrosion and venereal disease. No, this book has a sunny ending in which everyone turns out to know a little bit more about literature and life than you expected them to. And it made me very, very happy. In order to instill a little levity in the room, I thought I'd ask Edward to read a parody section first. There'll be a couple of readings during this, in which one of the nominated writers has written a historical novel from the point of view of William Shakespeare.
Okay. Yes, this is a member of the committee of the Elysian Prize. She's called Penny Feathers. And Malcolm is the chairman. Other people mentioned I don't think other people are mentioned. Tobias is an actor, traditionally a Booker committee has a second-rate actor, a backbench MP, a retired civil servant, and then there's a sudden rush of panic and they get an academic on board. And it's the usual selection. Anyway, so Penny had been asked by Malcolm to check out Tobias's favourite novel, All the World's a Stage. According to the blurb, it was an ambitious and original novel written by a young New Zealander from the point of view of William Shakespeare. It gave a richly textured portrait of Jacobean London, as well as taking the reader inside the mind of the greatest genius in all of human history. Penny felt instinctively that this one would be a survivor. Choosing a New Zealander would be a salute to the Commonwealth, and at the same time, the theme was patriotic and educational. With the long list being announced tomorrow, she plunged straight in. William, Ben, do you know Thomas Kidd and John Webster? Lads, said William, giving the men a friendly nod. Thomas returned his smile, but John continued to scowl out of the window, ignoring William. John would as soon bastinado a man's shanks as shake his hand, explained good Master Johnson. He was not yet 13 when he murdered the blacksmith he was apprenticed to. News came in that day of great Marlowe's death, and John was thrown into the blackest grief. There's a great spirit gone, quoth he. Indeed, the tears lie in an onion that should water that sorrow, quoth the blacksmith. Whereupon such a choleric humour came o'er John that he lifted the glowing poker from the coals of his master's furnace and plunged it into the wretched blacksmith's entrails. Never a man died with a more astonished expression on his face, unless it was King Edward, second of that name. Before William could respond to this amazing tale of murder most foul, strange, and unnatural, John rose up in his chair in a state of great excitation and pointed through the window. All eyes, my Lord Essex comes hard upon us with a great retinue of men. How finely caparisoned they are and point device in their accoutrement. Oh, happy horse that bears the weight of Essex, said William, straining out of the casement to catch a glimpse. See how his mount's proud, impatient hoof does bring far from the cobblestone, said old Thomas Kidd. How like a god is he in countenance, in bearing, how like a king. William sank back down next to Master Ben despondently. My pleasure lies in Essex, he sighed. But I wait in vain for any sign or any summons. I am a mere slave that tends upon the hours and times of his desire. Come, William, said Ben, slapping him on the shoulder. Enough of that. Let us have one more gaudy night and mock the midnight bell. I've sold my latest play to this innkeeper for 5 shillings of sack. He understands not a word of it, poor fool, but hopes to sell it for a profit to the Chancellor's men. Would I had a play to sell, said William, and we would have roasted capons withal. But I only started one this morning and shall not finish it till the morrow. Those were the days. What is its argument, said Ben. Why, it is a Roman play, said William. It tells the tale of Antony and how one of the three pillars of this world was made into a strumpet's fool. Penny couldn't help admiring the way it made you feel you were really in the tavern with William Shakespeare and his pals. That was the wonderful thing about historical novels. One met so many famous people. It was like reading a very old copy of Hello magazine. She read on eagerly.
So we're going to get in this book a kind of assembly of foolish writers and foolish readers. The author of the William Shakespeare novel from New Zealand has found a kindred soul in Penny Feathers, who served in the Foreign Office, is it?
That's right.
She was the head of the permanent secretary's main squeeze. Her primary job was always to make sure that there was tea available, and if not tea, gin and tonics. And, you know, if not tea or gin and tonics, at the very least, what else? A stiff upper lip. You know, she's British. And, you know, so she's very proud as far as she's concerned. The job of the committee is to find a writer who will be liked by the largest number of people up and down the coast of this great country of ours. In other words, it has nothing to do with literature. It may be, the subject may be literary, but what would make it literature is unknown to any but one of these judges. And that one, Vanessa, knows so well that she makes the other judges hate her. You see, she's a teacher, and they don't like being lectured to. They're adults. They don't want to be told what literature is. If they don't know by now, they'll never know. The answer is, they'll never know. That's the kind of book this is. So that the one person capable of telling them is not capable of making them want to hear. Now, how did you design this?
It was a very playful, inventive process, and also collaborative. I wrote it very fast, and then with my Melrose novels, I would seal them up. I'd rewrite them 50 times. I'd hand them in, not actually saying, because I'm too polite, print this, but that's what I really meant. I didn't want a word changed. Whereas with this, I knowingly handed in a mess and collaborated with my editors. I mean, in the first version, there was a member of the committee who was a celebrity chef with reading difficulties, and and my agent just thought I'd gone too far, you know? And so I threw him out, and I brought in a Cambridge academic, just like that. You know, it was characters just came to me, scenes came to me. It was this feeling of liberation of writing without, you know, without the terrible responsibility of having to save my life by writing, but just to play. I kind of missed out on play when I was younger. And so I've started rather late in the day playing, and I love it, you know.
Well, one of the marvelous things, there's a writer in the book who's she's a good writer. Her name is Burns. What's her first name?
Catherine.
Mm. And in fact, most of the men in the book sleep with her, sometimes together. And she is gifted, yes, at making men fall in love with her, but then she doesn't know what to do with them. She's kind of bewildered. She's also gifted at shutting the door on them, saying, you know, this is over, this isn't working, goodbye. And so she can bring them in and send them out, and the in-between, you know, is silence. You know, there's nothing she can do. And one of her, do you still call them paramours? One of her boyfriends is, of course, it was inevitable. It had to happen. He's a literary theorist. She wants to be as silent as possible when he's around. He never wants to stop talking because he has an analysis, a theory about everything. And one of the reasons that literature has, what would you say, molted in our time, is that theory has altered the nature of language. When you start to look at words as if they were incapable of bearing the freight of meaning, when your basic idea is that language cannot communicate, you end up with a populace that is no longer able to read. This Frenchman, of course he's a Frenchman, is named Didier. And he is very, at least to my mind, he sounds to me like Baudrillard. But, you know, there's any number of inspiration points. Let's hear what he does, because he just sits down at the computer and starts to... This isn't writing, it's typing, said Truman Capote about Jack Kerouac. Ditto.
I didn't know that. That's good. Didier watched as the coffee trickled from the espresso machine in Catherine's kitchen into a tiny cup resting on the metal grill beneath. Knowing that the fourth espresso was usually the one to tip him into a frenzy of creativity, he knocked back the bitter little draught while it was still steaming, placed the cup directly in the sink, and returned with relish and a slightly burnt mouth to his computer. Catherine was out for the day, giving him the further impetus of solitude. He was soon typing rapidly, thrilled by the intelligence and authority of the words rippling onto the screen. Nietzsche announced the death of God. Foucault announced the death of man. The death of nature announces itself, with no need for an intermediary. As these three elements of our classical discourse dissolve in the acid rain of late capitalism, we are offered the consolation of its own pale triumvirate, the producer, the consumer, and the commodity. Thanks to advertising, the producer sells the commodity to the consumer. Thanks to the internet, the consumer is the commodity sold to the producer. This is the utopia of borderless democracy, a shift of signifier in the desert of the real. This is the playground of unlimited freedom, the opportunity to define ourselves through the gratification of ever more perverse and hybridized fetishism. This is the celebrated openness of a technology that is at the service of perpetual supervision. It is this open field that is the supreme disguise. In the absence of the hidden object, we cannot see what we see because we have abandoned the need to search. As for searching, let our engines do it for us. The thought that cannot think itself is that we will die of thirst before we reach the shining city of individual gratification, which was never made of anything other than the shimmering heat waves of a collectively conditioned desire. In the rhetoric of bourgeois liberalism, conformity deploys the language of rebellion precisely because there is no possibility of revolution. We are at the point in history where it is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. The anxiety once expended...
Wait, did you hear that, by the way? It is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. That's really funny.
The anxiety once expended on the mutual annihilation of warring political ideologies is now expended on universal annihilation through ecological catastrophe. Preferably, of course, a catastrophe that is not going to happen, rather than the one that is happening. We would rather watch a movie about the threat of a meteor from outer space than contemplate the actual impact of the capitalist meteor on the Earth. We may be frivolous consumers of information who cannot stop eating popcorn until the US Air Force has saved humanity by destroying the alien meteor with nuclear weapons. Or we may be serious consumers of information who enjoy the voluptuous guilt of betraying the polar bear, or worry that our grandchildren may never know the pleasures of skiing in the Alps, or wish that we had bought an apartment on a higher floor of the Manhattan skyscraper where we live. Finally, it is of no importance, because both catastrophes, the fantastic and the actual, are deployed to distract us from the desert of the real into which we have marched the exhausted culture of the West. In this desert, it is forbidden to think. Even if capitalism is the crisis, capitalism must be the solution.
Go ahead.
Shall I go on?
Yes.
Didier paused, waiting for a second preposterous paradox to pop into his head. He was en pleine forme, no doubt about that. Would another espresso send him spiralling into a circular and inconclusive sterility, or keep him riding on the rushing and glittering wave of la pensée? Before he could decide, the ping of an incoming email drew his attention to the lower corner of the screen. He would usually have ignored an email in the midst of writing, but this one was from Catherine and might require a quick reply. He clicked on his mail icon and read her passage. Didier, you'll probably think me very cowardly to tell you this by email, but I don't feel that I can go on being with you. I know this is the second time, and that you'll think I shouldn't have taken you back if I wasn't serious. But my restlessness is, as you might say, structural and not personal. I would have left whoever I was with at this point because I need continual change to keep me ahead of the wolf pack, whatever that is. I'm going to Italy with a girlfriend for 2 weeks. I have the inkling of a new novel and want to see if I can start it there. You're welcome to stay in the flat until I get back. Please forgive me and don't cut me off from your wonderful company unless you have to. Love, K. Didier felt the glittering wave collapse around him and found himself tumbling and spinning and struggling to know which way was up. How could she do that? How could she suddenly do that? He thought of Lacan's opaque but strangely compelling remark, "Woman does not exist," which does not mean that she cannot be the object of desire. Whatever charm this insight had once held for him, it slipped through his grasp as he groped for a sane response to Catherine's email. She had ruined a day's writing. That, at least, was a concrete starting point for his resentment. Mercifully, his focus on lost writing reminded him that he would one day enfold his present suffering into a masterful analysis of desire or love or delusion. It hardly mattered. He would perform a vivisection without anesthetic on any abstract noun that presumed to rule his life. He knew it would be some time before he could gather enough detachment for that task. Rome wasn't deconstructed in a day, he thought, immediately typing the sentence onto his screen to see if he felt the return of some measure of control. He did not. Didier got up from his desk and suddenly swept the coffee cup from its ledge of papers, smashing it against the wall of Catherine's drawing room. He would have his revenge. He didn't yet know what it would be, but he would write something about love or delusion or desire that she would never forget. As this thought died out, Didier pictured himself sweeping the coffee cup against the wall and suspected there was something staged about the gesture. Yes, he'd been in the stupidity of his unconscious and its mechanical discharge of emotion. He wished he could have the coffee cup back, so that he could experience the full tension between the gestural cliché and the more subtle and refreshing operations of his intellect, and then refuse the gesture. He sat down again and typed out a sentence. Impulsiveness always points to the absence of spontaneity. That was better. He could work with that. In the meantime, he had joined Sam and Alan in Catherine's Salon des Refusés. Would he try to preserve the dignity of having lasted a few more weeks than either of his rivals, or join them in an enclave of nostalgia and bitterness? There were several emails from Sam he had not answered because of the danger of being unavoidably, or structurally, as Catherine would want him to say, so as to enforce the tyranny of English facetiousness, patronizing. He might now be able to reply to Sam, but first he would reply to Catherine. Didier got up again and started pacing the room. The wolf pack she was keeping ahead of. That was the way in. He felt the richness of its hermeneutic potential. Once he started interpreting something, the problem was how to stop. All he needed was a first sentence and one more espresso.
I was shocked when I asked Edward to read a DDA passage that he hadn't read them publicly before, whereas I find them irresistible, because this is what, I hate to say it, but this is what a freshman, a sophomore, a junior, and a senior English class rolled into one sounds like nowadays. And I do think it's both hilarious and unfortunate. But I wanted to then talk about the comic novel. Mm. They aren't much being written. You know, they're not... they once were inevitable. You know, P.G. Woodhouse rhymes with good house, not roadhouse, as I remember. Evelyn Waugh.
Yeah.
Evelyn Waugh finding his mentor in Ronald Fairbank and writing essays on Fairbank and that diction and saying, you know, that it was irrefutably comic and finding it impossible to resist stealing something from Fairbank. Fairbank has a piece of gossip, and I think it's called The Flower Under the Foot, in which it's revealed and spreads around the novel that there are fleas in the Ritz. Waugh found this irresistible and repeated it in his novels. But why do we no longer have a comic novel, given the ludicrousness of so much that's around us?
I don't know. I'm glad you've said it's a comic novel rather than a satirical novel, and I think you're exactly right. It is celebratory and inclusive and not contemptuous and exclusive, you know. And it's been mechanically treated as a satire. It has satirical elements, but the conclusion changes it into a comic novel. And in fact, this novel, a satire on prizes, which I thought would, you know, give me some relief from the anxiety of whether I would ever win a literary prize, has in fact provoked two prizes already, and it's only about 2 weeks old. So they're trying to smother me with prizes. And I won the P.G. Woodhouse Prize for a comic novel only the other day.
Really?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
And it's every writer's dream come true. You get to have a pig named after your novel.
No!
Because of the Empress of Blandings, a pig in Woodhouse's work. And so I thought I was going to get a sweet little squealing piglet and, you know, be able to say, I christened thee Lost for Words. But far from it, to my horror, they recycle this old sow, which now has an appalling identity crisis, because she's been named after 12 comic novels and doesn't know who she is anymore. Anyway, and so I was photographed with my sow smiling in the torrential rain in Hay on Wye, and that was a moving moment. And it is a comic novel, and I think that there's a view that comic novels aren't serious and that they're slightly embarrassing and that they're light, you know, compared to people, you know, writing about dying or something. And I disagree quite deeply. You know, I think that there are only a few instruments for liberation. You know, when I was writing the Melrose books and trying to find a way out of the kind of entrapment that Patrick Melrose is in, there didn't seem to be very many ways out, and insight was one way out, But laughter is another way. I think that that comedy is a very serious instrument of liberation and protest against the, you know, the tyranny of suffering. You know.
I think. Let me see. Tell me if this is true. Ha. You know, I'm famous for asking things that aren't questions. So if I find a way, a formula, tell me if this is true. I feel very proud of myself. But tell me if this is true. It seems to me that a comic novel needs, to propel it, an exquisite control of syntax, that really it's sentence structure that makes a novel a comic novel, and that you Brits, if you'll pardon me, have it all over us because your syntax is so much better than ours.
But I'm not going to say yes to that. I mean, surrounded by hundreds of Americans. No, I mean, I don't know. I think, you know, syntax. I mean, Didier would agree with you. Syntax gets in everywhere. But brevity is very important, and that that comedy comes perhaps it's sort of. I'm making this up, by the way.
No, we're making
the first witnesses of this nonsense. But it's adverbial, you know. It's about how things are done, those are the I think dynamic elements, and then incongruity, just sharp, you know, uncomfortable contrasts. I'm very attracted to all of those elements, and that in a way there's continuity between. We shouldn't overemphasize the difference, between the Melrose books and these books. In the Melroses, there are hilarious passages. They're basically a tragic story of the destruction of an individual and the downfall of a family. But you know, the hilarity keeps breaking out over the surface. And, you know, inversely, in this comic novel, there are some serious moments when Alan, rejected by Catherine, plunges into depression, when Vanessa's thinking about her anorexic daughter, when Sam's thinking about unrequited love. I can't do just one or the other. I think I see the world as both heartbreaking and absurd, and at the same time. And Auden said that thing, you know, suffering takes place while someone else is eating. So you don't forget the someone else who's eating. But equally, laughter takes place while someone else is suffering. You know, and that's the inclusiveness and that I'm really interested in, and the proportions have changed drastically in this novel. It's 20% serious, 80% comic, rather than whatever the mix is in the Melroses. It's a different kind of cocktail, but it's got the same ingredients in it.
I just understood what I was saying, by the way. I didn't mean to sound like DDA. What it amounts to when you it's there in the syntax is that what we always say about comedy, it's all in the timing. In a sentence read, syntax is the equivalent of timing. It's the pace. And, you know, when you've got your short chapters running all over the place, we're in India in one moment, we're being surprised by Chinese entrepreneurs who've bought up the literary prize, and imagine this, they say the things we want them to say about literature. They're the voice of reason in the novel. And you just go, oh, he did that without even signaling me that he was about to.
Exactly.
I thought, I'm in for danger. We're in the last chapter of this novel, and now Chinese industrialists have bought the prize. Is it going to be the occasion for racism? Is this book going to fall into the abyss of its premises? No. Mr. and Mrs. Woe, as they're called, not Woo, know more about literature than anyone else we meet in the novel, including Vanessa.
Subtle move, wasn't it?
It was thrilling.
I'm glad you appreciated that. But that's what, yeah, that's what I meant by brevity, what you're calling pace. We're talking about the same thing. My average chapter length in the other novels I've written is probably around 11 pages, and here it's almost half. And that just that simple fact tells you that I set off at a different pace, and that's a comic pace. I agree.
But, you know, so nicely done, because the thing to do in your last scene of a comedy or a farce is make sure all your characters are in hand in the same place.
And that's why the last chapter is much longer, and it's like the dance, as you say, at the end of a
yes.
Shakespeare play. Everyone comes together, and everyone is in some way redeemed, you know, despite their limitations. I also think this book is about... I mean, it has got some serious themes to it. I think it's about the disease of constant comparison. And the literary prize is... a literary prize is inherently a comparative activity. But there's a more general implication that we might... Well, certainly in my case... A lot of us are wasting our lives with this constant comparison, constant sense of wanting to be better than something or that something else is less good or that we're less good than something. And the novel ends with the word incomparably, because at last, you know, someone in the novel is having an experience which can't be compared and judged and evaluated against any other experience. And in a sense, neither can literature. If the point of a book is not to, of a writer, is not to be able to compare them to another writer, but to be unable to compare them to another writer. You know, it's not because I'm like Evelyn Waugh, which incidentally I'm not, that there's any value to my writing. You know, or as with every writer, it's the fact that no one else can do what they do that gives them any value at all. If they can be compared to someone else, read the person they can be compared to instead.
Well, I want to read it as you've written it, and rather than have it summarized. And it's very nice, because in the old days, they used to, I think it was Kenneth Burke, who used to say, watch for the repetition of certain words in the course of a novel, and you'll know what the theme of the novel is. And just as the last word in this novel is incomparably, the definition of comparable is, what's that funny word? Adumbrated. Adumbrated earlier on when that industrialist says as follows. They ask him, since he is the new big cheese, after all. What direction do you see yourself taking the prize in? It's a prize for literature, said Mr. Woe. I hope it will go in the direction of literature. My wife takes a great interest in these things. Personally, I think that competition should be encouraged in war and sport and business, but that it makes no sense in the arts. If an artist is good, nobody can do what he or she does, and therefore all comparisons are incoherent. Only the mediocre, pushing forward a commonplace view of life in a commonplace language, can really be compared. But my wife thinks that, quote, Least Mediocre of the Mediocre is a discouraging title for a prize. Mr. Woe couldn't help laughing. Well, neither can we. I think it's time to open up to you for questions, and thank you all for being here.
Hello.
When I discovered the Patrick Melrose novels, it was because a friend had recommended them. And I read them, and I was aghast, I mean, in the best possible way. I mean, I was transformed. And I looked around to see what had been written about them. And in the American press, at that time, there was very little. And I don't know if it was the same in Great Britain, but now here you are with this novel, and you have the New Yorker profile, which was wonderful. But I just wondered if you had a theory about why it kind of took its time penetrating, at least here in America, and does literature kind of take its own time in some mysterious way that we can't measure?
I just don't know the answer to that. I mean, in England, I have a sense that it was to do with inverted snobbery and a kind of hostility to an idea of something I'm supposed to represent and don't. So there was a great resistance to the idea that I was a real writer. Everything was done to represent my writing as just some sort of transcription of a few scandalous incidents, as if I'd experienced life in sentences and hadn't written them myself, and that there was no real work involved. In France, on the contrary, they immediately said that I was a writer with the first book, but the English were very resistant, I think, because of hostility to an idea of where I came from. And then in America, my books were just turned down year after year, book after book, by every publisher from shining sea to shining sea. On the grounds that they were too British, or they were too dark, or they were too French, or they were too American, or I don't know, but they were, because they, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, Bad News is set entirely in New York. You know, quite a lot of Mother's Milk is. Nevermind is set in France. I mean, but there was a huge resistance to publishing them over here. The happiest experience of my career was in 2012, when all five Melrose books were published in America. And, you know, contrary to all these gloomy predictions, people understood them and enjoyed them. And I was very, very pleased about that. But it was a long time, yeah. For 14 years, I probably only had, you know, a couple of thousand readers, and I knew quite a lot of them personally.
Oh, thank you. I'm listening to the Melrose novels now. They're my version's read by Alex Jennings. That seemed like kind of a coup to get the great Alex Jennings to read the book. So I wondered, did you choose him or audition him, or did you have anything to do with that selection? They're really read wonderfully.
Oh, good. I'm glad about that. I haven't heard all of them. The audio department of Picador asked him to do them, and he agreed. And I was asked if I wanted to go on along and listen to the recording, and I didn't in general, but then I thought I wanted to listen to him do the voices chapter in Bad News. In the second Melrose novel, Patrick, the protagonist, is taken over by these voices, and in the form of compulsive mimicry, he can't stop turning into one character after another. And it's a very challenging chapter to read. And it was very autobiographical in the sense that that had, you know, it was just that millimeter of control and theatricality that kept me away from full-blown schizophrenia. The fact that I was acting out, I couldn't stop myself from doing it, but I was just slightly in charge by doing the impersonation. And so the voices felt very personal to me. And I wondered how Alex Jennings was going to do them. And of course he didn't do them as I used to do them. But he did them really well. And I left feeling that the books were in safe hands, isn't the right, safe vocal cords. I felt it was a brilliant performance, brilliant.
Hi, I love your books, and I have to say the dinner party scene in the third novel has to be one of the funniest scenes of any book I've ever read. And what's shocking about it, though, is that you name names with Princess Margaret, and I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about any fallout that you had from using a real person's name in such a biting way.
I mean, that's... It's been done before, hasn't it? The Napoleon is in War and Peace. and the Princess de Parme is in one of Proust's books. You know, it's an old soap opera tradition. You know, the guest appearance, and so, I mean, if I had called her Princess Marigold or something, I mean, what would have been gained, and so much would have been lost. And besides, also the royal family can't sue, so. I wanted to get it, I needed to have a real figure of that kind to be the epicenter of this kind of snobbish, frivolous world, which is related to the serious themes of the novel. The novels, you know, cruelty is obviously one of the serious themes of the Melrose books. But this constant belittling of other people, discounting of other people, you know, snobbery is essentially, there are two kinds, but one of them is, wanting to dismiss people in advance, you know, to be relieved of the burden of empathy by just deciding that whole swathes of humanity don't count. And this is a... So there's a relationship between this frivolous social world and the really dark aspects of the novel. And I needed to have at the centre of it someone who was who really had that kind of magnetism and glamour. And it was simply easier to use someone who had that sort of effect and who in her own way misused her power, not in the way that David Melrose misuses his parental power. But nevertheless, she misused her power. She could have, like her sister, who I adore, you know, could have made people feel better. And that's not how she spent her time, you know, I'm sorry to say. A lot of the things Princess Margaret says are pretty much quotations, you know.
Hi. It's great to be here. The Patrick Melrose books had such a profound effect on me that I've been sort of afraid to look at any of the other books, you know. And you reading from it, all of a sudden hearing that voice, it was the same voice and the brilliance and the intelligence and the humor, just opened the gate and it's like, oh yeah, okay, I got to get that book. I got to read it. So thank you for that. And also, you know, a lot of the great novels in this country were rejected for 10 years. So I think, the best ones, they're in good company. But I have a short question. You know, you talked about in the Melrose novels that you would reach I forget the word you use, but like a transcendence of, you know, almost a therapeutic thing. And that was a great thing from the novels. And I'm just wondering if in this new novel or in your writing in general, you get some form of that as well, or if that was because of the particular subject matter only in, you know, in those...
I think this novel is an expression of the freedom gained in the last chapter of At Last. And what, you know, what Patrick Melrose discovers in the last chapter was something I was discovering simultaneously. You know, I had no idea how I was going to finish the Melrose series. And, you know, the ego and the alter ego, and there was nothing to look back on, no epiphany that I was then going to tell the reader. I discovered the resolution by writing it. And I wrote it in tears, you know, of relief. And it was a very powerful experience for me. And I think this novel is the expression of that freedom, rather than a new level of freedom. If I ever reach a new level of freedom, there'll have to be another Melrose novel. We could have a happy Patrick Melrose. How many of you would buy that? I mean, the thing is, but happiness is probably the hardest thing to describe. Almost no one has tried that. So I do love a challenge, but I will have to do some research first.
One more?
Is it on? I loved the series, and I have been thinking about it and trying to figure out what I wanted to ask you. So I wanted to ask if you could speak a little bit to the vacillation, the constant vacillation in the books between subject and object, and how I as the reader was unknowingly flipping between thinking of Patrick as this fictional character and then as you, back and forth. And I was wondering how you felt when you were writing that, putting him in the third person, for instance, rather than doing a tell-all autobiography or whatever. And I started then thinking about all these instances in the book where if you're injecting yourself, your subject and object, and you've got the gecko image. And I guess what I really wanted to find out is how that felt writing it. Did you experience that shift, constant shift, between those two places?
It's a complex question, but I think to some extent what you experienced was a distorting effect of publicity, of knowing that there was a high autobiographical content to the novels. I didn't give an interview until I'd finished the first three, and there was the possibility until 1994, when the first three were finished, of reading them without knowing whether they were autobiographical or not. But I think I would say that I chose the third person because I think it's actually a better instrument for intimacy than the first person, because the first person narrative welds a writer to a persona, and then it restricts the potential for movement. All the action is in the gaps, you know, between the author and the narrator, between the narrator and the character. And those gaps can become impacted if you use the first person singular. I think it's a potentially, you know, disastrous pronoun. And the other thing is I wanted a third-person narrative because I wanted the freedom to drop into any mentality that I chose to drop into, because I wanted to surround the situation with points of view rather than just to telling one person's story. I was never attracted to memoir at all. You know, I wanted to write a novel that would, you know, in which the truth was always qualified by another point of view. Patrick has a certain view of his father, but someone comes up to him in the third book and says, "Your father saved my life." You know, he has a view of his mother, but Annette thinks his mother's a saint. You know, I felt it was crucial to establish that kind of complexity. That's what was going to set me free, rather than just complaining. You know, everybody's suffered. It's totally unimportant that I've suffered in itself. You know, I'm like everyone else. It was just the question of, you know, how we can become free from an obsession with our own suffering. That's what interested me. And that I didn't think a first-person narrative would give the answer to.
Thank you all so much for coming.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.